Chapter 4. The Settlers. On a wintry day in 1823, a tall, beefy wanderer with a bland, open face like a rising sun stood with his scrawny wife, pudgy 11-year-old son, and three mongrel hunting dogs at the edge of a rain-filled bayou in the western reaches of the new state of Louisiana. A straggler from Tennessee, who had fled to avoid bankruptcy and jail, he was not pleased with what faced him. "Don't mind the water. We can wade through it. Done so many times in our exploration. But I do worry about this next stretch between here and Texas." "We'll get through," his red-headed wife mumbled. Reaching for her rather unpleasant son, she warned, "You're to stay close, Yancey. Help us load the guns if they attack." The three were dressed in buckskin garments, laboriously cut and sewn by the mother, who appeared to be responsible for all vital decisions, while her pompous husband thrashed about deciding issues which never seemed to matter. The conspicuous thing about the family was the incredible amount of gear each member carried. Guns, an axe, pots, extra articles of clothing, and bundles of dried food. From every angle of their bodies, useful items protruded, so that they looked like three porcupines waddling through the woods. They were so impeded that they could cover only about 9 miles a day, when better organized travelers would have completed 15. "We'll head due west," the father said, as if he were a general. "Make the shortest transit possible, and be safe in Texas before they know we're about." His introduction of words like exploration and transit betrayed the fact that he had, at some earlier time, known life within a respectable Tennessee family. But a love of petty gambling and a positive addiction to idleness had led to a sad decline in his fortunes. His fall had not been spectacular, just a slow erosion of holdings and a series of disastrous lawsuits over land titles. When his family lost interest in his welfare because of his marriage to the daughter of a shiftless frontiersman, he had no recourse but to leave home, a man with no land, no prospects, and very little hope of improving his lot. "Will there be Indians ahead?" the boy asked.
"Worse, renegades. White men turned sour."
This man, 33 years old, had decided in the fall of 1822 that his condition in Gallatin, Tennessee, was so deplorable that he could escape only by taking to the road. Nashville to Memphis to Little Rock, to the southwest corner of the Arkansas Territory. He and his family had struggled to reach the banks of the Red River, which he had followed into Louisiana. There they had cut west toward the Mexican frontier state of Tejas, known along the Mississippi as Texas, refuge for any American who wanted to start his life over in a new and burgeoning area. But to reach this reported paradise from Louisiana entailed great risk. For when travelers came to these final bayous separating the civilization of New Orleans and its outriders from the wilderness of Texas, they faced, as the Jubal Quimpers did now, about 30 miles of one of the most dangerous territories in the Americas. "Listen," they were told, "and listen close. In the old days, they called it the neutral ground, meaning it didn't belong to neither Louisiana nor Texas. They hoped that, setting it up like that, they'd be able to avoid conflict between Americans and Spaniards. But what did they attract? Pirates, murderers, smugglers, women who deserted their families, runaway slaves who stabbed their masters, forgers. Finally, they gave it to Louisiana, but it's still scum of the earth. Hell hides in that strip across the water." "I don't want to go," Yancey said. But his mother caught him by the arm and moved him toward the bayou. "We were pushed out of Tennessee. Got nothing left but Texas." Then, touching a sack she had protected since starting their exodus, "We get this corn planted before May, or we starve."
Jubal was about to plunge into the muddy water when a voice from the east halted him. "Hey there, Tejas maybe?" The family turned to see a remarkable sight. A roundish, white-haired, ruddy-faced Irishman in the habit of a Catholic priest, holding his hat in his left hand and puffing heavily as he anxiously endeavored to catch up. For, like the others, he was frightened of the strip. When he overtook the Quimpers, they saw that he carried very little baggage. A small knapsack made from untanned deerskin, a simple bedroll of sorts, and a battered book, apparently a Spanish Bible, for its spine carried in faded gold lettering the words Santa Biblia. From its ragged leaves protruded ends and bits of paper, for it served as his file. "I am Father Clooney, puff, puff, of County Clare, gasp, gasp, servant of God and the government of Mexico." He uttered the first syllable of his name and of his native country in a beautiful Irish sing-song, which made his round face break into radiant smiles as he proudly said the words. "I'm Jubal Quimper, Methodist, Gallatin, Tennessee, on my way to Texas. And what are you doing in these parts?" The priest told a most improbable yarn. "When the wine was red, I told my bishop in Ireland to go to the devil, and before firing me he advised, 'Francis Xavier Clooney, you may think that your bishop should go to eternal damnation, but you must never express it.' I could find no assignment in Ireland. Bishops have evil memories. So I emigrated to New Orleans, and could find no parish there. Bishops have long arms. When the Spanish government, some years back, announced that they wanted priests to serve in Tejas, few Spaniards being willing to work there, I sailed to Mexico and volunteered. I was about to take charge of all Tejas north of San Antonio when the Mexicans threw the Spaniards out and my job was gone again. The new rulers in Mexico City told me, 'We're sending our own people to Tejas. We need no strangers.' So back I sailed to New Orleans. But they soon found that Mexican priests were just as reluctant to move into Tejas as Spaniards had been. So back they came running. 'Father Clooney, we need you.' 'Did you learn Spanish?' Quimper asked. And the priest, still puffing from his run, said, 'Some. I can conduct prayers, in Latin, much like Spanish. And you?' 'You wander through these parts, you pick up words here and there.' 'Did you say you're an official of the Mexican government?' 'In North Tejas, I'll be the Catholic Church. I'm to conduct the baptisms, the marriages, the conversions.'
'Conversions?'
'Yes. You told me you were Methodist, a respectable religion, I'm sure, but not the right one. Unless you convert to my religion, you'll get no land in Tejas, and you may even be thrown out.'
'I can't believe that,' Quimper said. But it was his wife who made the stronger statement. 'We'll stay Methodists.'
'Then go no farther,' the priest said. And from his ragged Bible, he produced a paper printed in Mexico City, and delivered to the Mexican consul in New Orleans, which laid down the rules. Spreading it in the rain, he and Quimper, with their fractured Spanish, deciphered the explicit law. No immigrant will be allowed to take residence in Tejas or acquire land there unless he brings with him documents proving that he is of law-abiding character, and if he is not already a member of the Roman Catholic Church, he must convert. Quimper showed the document to his wife, and then asked Father Clooney how the law could be evaded if one was of reasonably good character but not a Catholic.
"Impossible," the priest said. "And I'm surprised you'd ask me such a question, since I'm sent here to uphold the law."
"What can I do?" Quimper asked, his big, undisciplined body betraying his agitation.
"You can become a good Catholic, like the law stipulates." Father Clooney had a singing vocabulary acquired in the Catholic schools of Ireland, and was always introducing words like stipulate into his conversation.
I'm being sent into Tejas to convert men just like you, Quimper, so that you can legally take up your league and a labor.
What's that?
The Mexican government is considering a new law. Every Catholic immigrant will get free land, much more if he's married.
Consulting his document again, he said, a league is 4,428 American acres. A labor is 177. The rule is that you get a labor of free land if you intend to farm it, plus an entire league if you run cattle.
He coughed, folded the document, returned it to his Bible, and wiped the rain from his round face.
If I were you, I'd claim I intended running cattle.
We have no cattle.
We have no sunshine, said Father Clooney, but we expect to have some soon.
I must become a Catholic.
There's no other way.
And you can make me one?
That's me duty. That's why I'm here.
What do I do?
Lest he seem too eager to reject his inherited religion, Quimper added, I'm a good Methodist, you understand, but I must have land.
You kneel, and your wife and your son kneel, and I ask you a few simple questions.
The three Quimpers moved apart, the big, fleshy father of weak character, the thin, tense wife of tremendous moral force, and the flabby son who understood little and cared less, and who now said,
This paper says just what he said it did.
I will not accept land on such terms, Mattie Quimper said. And from the stern tone of her voice, Jubal realized that once more he was going to have difficulty with his headstrong wife.
You take the oath, or you go back to Tennessee. I'm bound for Texas.
I will swear to no such blasphemy, she said. And since nothing he could say persuaded her otherwise, it looked as if the Quimpers would end their escape to Texas at this bleak frontier. But now Father Clooney exercised that gentle logic for which he had been famous among his friends in Ireland. He did not have a superior mind, no one ever claimed that. But a friend at the seminary once said, He's highly flexible, finds solutions which you and I would never discover. Brushing Jubal aside, he took Mattie by the arm and asked in that sweet voice, Me daughter, it's land you crave, is it not?
When she nodded, he continued,
They told me in Mexico there were parcels along certain rivers in Tejas which exceeded that of Jerusalem or Ireland. Now, me girl, if you want to share in that land...
He stopped, smiled, and shrugged his shoulders.
Must I? She asked.
And he replied, You must.
She then asked, But does swearin' mean I give up my own religion?
And he said, smiling at her benignly,
Well, yes and no.
And she said,
I believe you, Father.
And she allowed him to lead her back to her family.
So the three Quimpers knelt in the Louisiana mud, their faces turned west toward Texas. It was a solemn moment both for them and for the priest, for they were formally rejecting a religion which had nurtured them, and he was performing his first official act as an agent of his new government. All were nervous as he whispered through the pattering rain, probing at his converts with a series of significant questions. Do you accept the body of Christ? Do you acknowledge in your hearts that the Holy Roman Catholic Church is the ordination of Jesus Christ himself? Do you accept without reservation the supremacy of our worldly father, the Pope? Are you willing to announce yourselves publicly as members of the Roman Catholic Church? When the three supplicants replied in whispers more muted than his own, Father Clooney administered the oath. But young Yancey noticed something that the white-haired priest could not see. His mother,
holding her hands behind her back, kept her fingers crossed. His father did not, and as soon as the final blessing was given, making them good Catholics, Jubal leaped to his feet and said, "Now, can we have this in writing?" And gladly, Father Clooney drew from his untidy Bible a printed document which he now filled in, attesting to the fact that Jubal Quimper et Uxor et Filius were good Catholics. But this did not satisfy Quimper. "You must write down that we're entitled to our league and a labor." "I have no authority to issue such a statement," Father Clooney said. Whereupon Jubal grabbed the certificate and was about to shred it. "Then I'm not a convert." "Wait," the priest said. "Is it so important to you?" And Quimper replied, "I'm willing to abide by the laws of any land I live in, but I demand that my new country put in writing its promises to me." "My words would carry little weight," Father Clooney protested. But Quimper said, "I've found that words on documents carry terrifying weight. I'm here in this swamp because of words on documents, and I want your words on this one." So the priest rummaged through his bedroll until he found a pen and a vial of ink. The paper he signed still exists in the archives of Texas. It is rain-spotted and not legally binding, but its import is unquestioned and was the foundation of everything good that was to happen to the Quimpers in Texas. This document testifies to the legal conversion into the true Holy Roman Catholic Church of Jubal Quimper, his wife Mattie, and their son Yancey, aged 11. By the laws of Mexico, this entitles them to take up, free and without hinder, a league and a labor of the best land, as he may identify it. The paper was signed boldly by Father Clooney, formerly of Ballycluney, County Clare, now an ecclesiastical representative of the Mexican government. Since these were his first conversions in his new assignment, he carefully dated the paper, 3 Enero, 1823, Provincia de Texas, Mexico. And when Quimper pointed out that they were not yet in Texas, Clooney said with that elasticity which would always characterize him, "In spirit we are, so let's make speedy tracks to take up our inheritance." Father Clooney, who had watched many struggling people trying to survive in a harsh world, was always concerned with the physical welfare of those he counseled. And now he gave the Quimpers solid advice. "You've got to buy a mule. You can't lug all that gear into Texas." But Jubal asked, "Who can afford a mule?" And Clooney replied, "We'll find a way." It was providential for both the Quimpers and the priest that they had joined forces at the bayou, for the transit of the neutral ground, where law did not prevail, proved more dangerous than even Jubal had anticipated. "I want all guns to be loaded," Quimper said as they entered the strip. And when Father Clooney warned, "The powder may get wet if we load now," Jubal said, "That's the risk we take." They were less than 6 miles inside the area when 3 Kentucky ruffians, fugitives from murder charges, accosted them and demanded tribute. When Father Clooney refused to surrender the few dollars and Spanish coins he had collected, they threatened to kill him as a conniving priest. "We don't want your kind in Texas." And they might have slain the 4 travelers had not one of the robbers dropped dead with a bullet through his head. Mattie Quimper, off to one side, had listened to the threats and had quietly reached for her husband's gun. Holding her breath to steady her arm, biting her lip to still her nerves, she had aimed not at the biggest Kentuckian's chest, but at his head. And when he dropped, she threw Father Clooney one gun and her husband another. And these 2 men happened to fire at the same survivor, killing him too. The 3rd renegade escaped through brush, and for the next 2 days the 4 immigrants kept a round-the-clock watch, lest the escapee return with others to seek revenge.
As they were about to leave the strip, they came upon a small settlement, perched on the left bank of the Sabine River, the boundary line between American Louisiana and Mexican Tejas. And here they were accosted by an extraordinary man, sour of face, lean of body, and profane of speech. "Ran me out of XXX Alabama, printing XXX dollar bills better than the XXX government. Now if you have any XXX Spanish coins, I can earn you a tidy XXX profit." He had been a blacksmith by trade, and might have made a good living almost anywhere in America or Texas had he applied himself to his calling. But he had an insatiable habit of manipulating coinage, and now he offered his services to the Quimpers. "What I do, I take a Spanish coin, pure silver, and I smash it so fartin' flat and in such a clever way." Into even a simple statement like that he was able to introduce three horrendous expletives, "that I can cut it into quarters." "Everybody does that," Quimper said. And he was right, for coinage was so scarce throughout America that the fracturing of dollars into four quarters, or sometimes even 8 bits, was common. "Of course everybody does it," the forger acknowledged. "But they cut a dollar into four quarters. I cut mine into 5. And he did. Taking a Spanish coin provided by the priest, he hammered it in such a way that, in the end, with the identifying marks preserved, he produced 5 pieces. Quimper was afraid to risk his own money in this criminal activity, but Father Clooney approved the inventiveness, and from his voluminous robes produced a handful of coins, which the forger quickly cut into 5s, keeping for himself 1/10 of the gain. As the priest was pocketing his profit, a dirty, ill-kempt boy of 9 or 10 ran up, shouting, "Black Abe done killed his woman," and everyone ran to see what new tragedy had struck an area accustomed to disaster. Black Abe, a white man from Missouri with an infamous reputation even among his evil companions, had tired of his woman's nagging and had stabbed her many times with a long knife. When the priest reached her, she was still breathing, but the flow of blood was so copious that she obviously could not survive. "Do you seek peace with your Maker?" Clooney asked softly. "No filthy papist touches me," she managed to whisper. And with that farewell to an ugly world, she died. Whereupon Father Clooney knelt by her bed and pleaded with God to accept the soul of this bewildered woman. The sanctity and emotion of the scene was broken by shrill yelling from outside, where the young boy who had brought the message to the forger's shop had taken a severe dislike to Yancey Quimper, much older and heavier than he. For no good reason, but with lethal skill, the little ragamuffin was belaboring Yancey, bringing blood to the nose and blackening to the eyes. "Stop it," young Quimper pleaded. And when his assailant continued pummeling him, he dropped to the ground, protecting his face with his hands. He had assumed, from having watched grown men fight in Tennessee, that when he fell to earth, the fight would end. But in the neutral strip, such a fall merely encouraged the attacker to finish off the job. And now, to the approving yells of the watchers, the fierce little tiger kicked at Yancey's head, then leaped upon him, boxing him about the ears with both fists. "Finish him," some of the men shouted. And the boy might have done so had not Father Clooney come out from the house where the dead woman lay. Striding into the middle of the cheering men, he drove off the boy and raised Yancey to his feet, brushing away the dirt and helping to stop the tears. Deprived of this amusement, the men roiled about for some minutes, after which one of them cried, "You can't do nothing with Black Abe. Let's hang him." So a posse was organized, and Abe was soon apprehended trying to escape through the canebrakes. Dragged back to the informal village on the Sabine, he was reminded of his many crimes and castigated for having slain one of the few women in the area. Abe, you gonna die. You want a prayer from this here priest passing through?
When Abe said that he did, Father Clooney stepped to the tree from which the rope dangled.
Son, despite your wicked ways, the Lord Jesus Christ intercedes for you at the throne of God. Your repentance is marked. Your immortal soul is saved, and you shall die in peace and in the perpetual love of Jesus Christ.
When the rope was hauled up by four big men, one of them the smith, and Black Abe's kicking stopped, Clooney said,
"I pronounce him dead. Bury him."
As an afterthought, he said, "Bury her, too, side by side, as they lived in this turbulent veil of tears."
That night, the Quimpers observed for the first time that their priest, in times of stress, as after this hanging, would search about for alcohol in which to drown his emotional insecurities. Tippling at first, he would progress quickly to real gulps, and when he was comfortably drunk, he would wander among whatever groups were sharing the whiskey, introducing himself with a benign smile.
"Me name's Father Clooney of Ballycloony on Clooney Bay in County Clare, servant of God and the government of Mexico."
He would sing the words, continuing for about an hour, after which he would calmly lie on the floor wherever he was and fall asleep. When morning broke, the four immigrants were so eager to enter Texas that the priest prevailed upon the forger, who operated a small ferry, to load them into his waterlogged craft and pull them across the muddy Sabine. As they reached the midpoint, Jubal happened to say the name of the river, whereupon the forger proved that he'd had a fair education.
"Ever newcomer says it like you just did. Sabine, no accent, rhymes with wine. Ancient Greek. Us locals call it Sabine. Heavy accent, last syllable. Rhymes with queen."
He deposited them on the slippery west bank just as a true deluge broke, inundating everything and especially the unprotected ferry, whose profane operator cursed God, the storm, and the crazy Catholic priest who had lured him into this predicament. Father Clooney paid no attention to either outburst. Shepherding his new flock as if they were 1,000 devout souls passionately addicted to his church, he asked them to kneel in the storm, and with water cascading down their faces and soaking their bodies, in a kind of heavenly baptism, the Quimpers entered Tejas. And when Jubal rose, he proclaimed rather sententiously, "We wanted to come. God brought us across the strip, and now we enter our inheritance." Matty did not immediately rise from her kneeling. Fingering the mud, she delivered an important judgment. "This earth can grow things. Let's find our land and get the seed in."
"We have time," her amiable husband assured her. But she said, "Even in paradise, if we miss the growing season, we run into trouble." And it was she who led the way south.
Father Clooney, now 58, and engaged in what would surely be his final assignment, felt himself fortunate to have found the Quimpers, whom he discussed with God in his prayers. "The boy's not much. He needs your help. The mother could build Rome in a week, and I hope you'll bless her. Did you see her gun down that bandit and then throw me the other rifle? The father? Now there you have a problem. Big, likable, in some ways younger than his son. But he's a good shot, and he does keep us in food. Tighten him up a bit." Together, the ill-assorted troop headed south and west into Mexican Tejas, toward the new Stephen Austin colony earmarked for American settlers. As they went, they lived off the land. And now Quimper was delighted to have Father Clooney as a hunting companion. For as a boy in Ireland, the priest had learned the mystique of firearms and enjoyed the ritual of stalking almost as much as the satisfaction of bringing home game. Clooney was a voracious eater, almost a glutton,
so he felt a vested interest in killing a deer or a bear with regularity. And he was good at butchering, so that during their journey the Quimpers and their spiritual leader fared well. Matty did not entirely trust this Irish priest, who claimed he worked for the Mexican government. But she was growing grateful to him for the work he did in their caravan. Always, he was first to volunteer for any task, something her husband never did, except where hunting or eating was concerned. She must make the fire and do the cooking, and form the lead bullets and tend the clothing, and at times seem to carry everything but the guns. With the arrival of this smiling priest, always eager to help if food was in the offing, she had a chance to breathe and to be a woman rather than a beast of burden. In fact, after their fifth day together, she found herself liking him, but her stern Protestantism prevented her from showing it. Two of his weaknesses disturbed her. The Methodist clergyman she had known stormed against drink and gambling, but Clooney engaged in both. For while she labored at cooking or sewing, he and Jubal would play at cards, using awkward pebbles as counters. The betting would become quite furious, and she would hear Clooney cry, "Aha, Quimper, you tried to hide that ace, and now you'll eat it." One night, when they were well into Texas, the two men sat playing cards as Matty inspected the precious corn seed to see if the two wads of smelly plug tobacco were still keeping away the weevils which would otherwise infest it. Clooney, seeing the colorful, easily handled kernels, cried, "I say, Matty, lend us a handful for our game." She demurred, for to her the corn was sacred, the agency of all that was to follow. But in the end, Jubal supported the priest. "Come on, Matt. We'll guard the corn with our lives. Aren't we using it like money?" So now the two noisy gamblers fought for kernels of corn, and the competition could not have been more keen had they been using Spanish pieces. But at the close of each session, there stood Matty, reaching out to reclaim and count her corn, which she put safely back into the canvas bag with the tobacco. When they were some 30 miles inside Texas, they came to their first settlement, a fragile collection of houses on Aish Bayou, and the comparison of this bayou with the one they had known in Louisiana was so favorable that Jubal had to comment, "This here is civilization. A man could choose his land right here and be happy." The citizens at Aish Bayou were so proud of their settlement that they suggested to the Quimpers, "Stay here. This land was made for farmers." But their real joy came when they learned that Father Clooney was a properly ordained priest, for they had seen no clergyman for many years, and early on the first morning a family that had moved down from Kentucky approached him with a compelling problem. Their daughter, 7 months pregnant, and her young man, a farmer also skilled in building log houses, had entered into a bond 2 years before, which they now presented to the priest as they were by honor required to do. Clooney had heard of such agreements and had been instructed in how to handle them, but he had not yet seen one, and he inspected the paper with a solemnity which the Quimpers had not previously observed. "Know all men by these presents that with the public knowledge of this community, the maid Rachel King and the bachelor Harry Burdine do undertake to live together as man and wife without benefit of clergy, there being none in these parts. We hold them to be truly married in the eyes of God, and on their part they undertake a solemn pact to marry legally as soon as a priest of the Holy Roman Catholic Church shall pass this way. In furtherance of this vow, they promise to pay a fine of $10,000 each if they fail to present themselves to said priest at first opportunity. We do this thing, all of us, because we are lost in the wilderness without church or clergy, but secure in the knowledge that Jesus Christ himself knew marriage to be a holy communion, blessed by God himself. Rachel and Harry are duly married, and promise they will confirm when the priest passes by.
This is a precious document, Father Clooney said as he returned it to the couple. If the others will join in a circle, we shall ask God's blessing on this marriage.
So the Quimpers, and all from the bayou who were available, formed a tight circle about the priest and the young couple, and in the simplest words the Irishman conducted a wedding and then gave a blessing. Recovering the paper for a moment, he scratched upon it the notation, Rachel and Harry were duly and properly married on the 10th of January, 1823, at Aish Bayou, Provincia de Texas. Father Francis X. Clooney, cleric of the Mexican government. As he was about to hand back the certificate, Chubal stopped him. Write that the couple, as good Catholics, are now entitled to their league and a labor. We already have it, Harry Burdeen said. But Quimper told him, it's good to have it in writing. And Father Clooney made the notation. At the wedding feast, real bread made from hoarded flour, and real whiskey made from corn, with venison and bear abundant. Four couples asked Father Clooney if he would convert them to his religion and give them certificates of proof. And Quimper noted the offhand manner in which the priest did this. It's as if he took the marriage seriously, he told his wife, and the conversions as a kind of necessary joke.
Priests don't make jokes, Mattie protested.
I think this one does. He knows we're doing this just to get some land, and he doesn't mind. But a marriage, that's forever, whether it's Catholic or whatever. This speculation ended when citizens of the bayou warned the newcomers as to what confronted them in their new homeland. Have all your papers in order when you get to Nacogdoches. You too, Father, because in Nacogdoches they're very strict. The way this difficult Indian name was pronounced reminded the Quimpers that they were now in a new country. For the sister town in Louisiana, Nacogdoches had been pronounced French-style, Nacatush, while only a few miles to the west, its sister town was called in the Spanish manner, Nacogdoches. And whenever the locals uttered it, they betrayed the fear and respect in which they held it. One old Mexican who had lived most of his life along the bayou explained why. Long ago, we had a big, important settlement across the Sabine in Louisiana. Los Adais, it was called, capital of all Texas. So one day, what happens? This Barón de Riperda from Spain arrives, finds that the people at Los Adais were trading with the French in New Orleans. And why not? There were no Spaniards in the area to trade with. And he becomes so angry that he finished Los Adais, just wiped it out. 500 settlers were given 5 days to gather all their goods and march down to San Antonio, 400 miles through forest and over swollen streams. They pleaded with him. No avail. Off they had to go, and 1 in 3 died on the way. Starvation, Indians, fever. The old man rocked back and forth, then pointed at Father Clooney. The priests did nothing to help. Everyone was afraid of Barón de Riperda. And you know what? Tell them what, Christopher. Christopher, a talkative farmer who ran a meager general store and lodging house, was quick to share bad news. When you reach Nacogdoches, who do you suppose you'll find in charge? The nephew of Barón de Riperda. Same kind of man, same kind of ideas. Says he wants to shut down Aish Bayou the way his uncle closed down Los Adais. He spat. Yes, the old Mexican resumed. You'll find this new Riperda in control and just as mean. You're still here, Quimper said. And the old man explained. The expulsion happened 50 years ago, and when we reached this spot, my father knew his family couldn't complete the journey. We'd all die. So he broke away. Wife, 3 children, me just 10 weeks old. And he said, Barón de Riperda can go to hell.
Father built us a log cabin. You can see it across that little stream. And there he raised corn and children and added rooms to the cabin. What you must do with this new Ripperdah, the settlers advised, is agree with everything he says. He won't issue you any land, of course, one of the women warned. He refuses to honor promises or contracts. Says we American Protestants are creeping in to steal Texas. I have papers, Quimper said. I'm a good Catholic. Several people laughed. We're all good Catholics. We're all entitled by law. But Ripperdah gives us no land. You seem to have yours. We've been here a while. Most of us came during the worst days of the neutral ground, just crept in, as Ripperdah says. How do you get title? We don't. What we do is hope that Ripperdah dies, or goes away, or somebody shoots him. When the four travelers reached Nacogdoches, they found two surprises. The little settlement was a real town, with a store and a lodging house. And to Father Clooney, Victor Ripperdah was not at all as he had been described by the dissidents at Aish Bayou. When the priest reported to him, he found a young man, thin as the noontime shadow of a reed, with a small mustache and a winning smile that displayed teeth of extreme whiteness. He was polite, deferential to any visitor, and meticulous where governmental detail was involved. You must understand from the start, I am not the alcalde. I am an army major guarding the frontier while the real alcalde is absent. Almost distastefully, he handed Clooney an order issued by that vanished official. Behold your alcalde. Citizens of Nacogdoches, I shall be absent 7 weeks. You must obey Major Ripperdah till I get back. Signed, James Dill, your alcalde. He's one of your Norte Americanos, Ripperdah explained, from Pennsylvania. How did he become alcalde of an important post? Clooney asked. And Ripperdah laughed. How did an Irishman become our priest? He then offered Clooney a drink and asked, What did they tell you about me when you entered Texas? Clooney did not want to reply, but when Ripperdah insisted, he said, They spoke of your uncle, the expulsion. Ripperdah shrugged. What lies they tell in their cabins. You know, he had little to do with that sad affair. The Marquise de Ruby, he made the decision, told my uncle to enforce it. Did 500 leave? Did 100 die? Yes, and my uncle did everything possible to help the survivors regain their old homes. He was a gentleman. Waving his hand before his face, as if to expunge recollections of the tragedy, he said, Father Clooney, we're so glad to see you. We haven't had a priest for some time, so you come to a land which hungers for your care. I'm proud to have so large a parish, so important a parish. Sit down, please. Manuel, fetch us more wine. Now, tell me, how did an Irishman who speaks such halting Spanish become priest of this vast area? Father Clooney took a copious draught of wine, savored it, wiped his forehead with the back of his hand, and smiled at his new superior. Francis X. Clooney of Clooney Bay in County Clare, Ireland. I told my bishop to go to hell. You never did. And he told me where I could go. New Orleans. Your Mexican consul found me there, hired me to work in Texas, told me to report to you and bring Christianity to this wilderness. You must not tell me to go to hell, Ripperdah said with an easy laugh. I have learned that superiors have powers which... He stopped. If I did, where would you send me? Without hesitation, Ripperdah said, Yucatan, that's where we send our bad boys, and our bad priests. It's a dreadful place. I'm here to help as you command, Clooney said. But Ripperdah corrected him.
I'm your superior, yes, but years may pass without my seeing you. And he pointed to a rude map of what the Mexican government assumed Zetaltejas to be, a thin sliver running from northeast to southwest. And Father Clooney saw that his territory extended from the Red River on the north, almost to San Antonio on the south, a distance of more than 350 wilderness miles, and at least 100 miles from east to west, a staggering total of 35,000 square miles. In Ireland, I had a parish of three villages. Of a Sunday, I could walk from one to the other. Here, you'll have a parish bigger than all of Ireland. My word, I do wish me old bishop could hear you say that. To walk this one will take 6 or 7 years. Marriages, baptisms, burials, they all await you. The serious official leaned back, stared at the priest, and said frankly, I would have expected a younger man. And Clooney replied, I've spent my life preparing to do some great work. Tejas is it. And who are those hapless three you brought with you? Ripardá asked. And Clooney corrected him. Quimper is the best hunter I've ever seen. Tennessee man. At the mention of this state, Ripardá groaned. Tennessee and Kentucky. They'll be the ruin of Tejas. Mind, I prophesied this. Up there they must teach boys to be animals. And when the Quimpers appeared before him, documents in hand, he refused to look at the papers or issue them land. You have no claim. I have no authority. I advise you, in your own best interests, go home. But the law says... My instructions tell me what the law is. In their six meetings with Ripardá, he never once claimed that he was the law. Meticulous in his observation of the proprieties, he referred always to some mystical body of law promulgated in Mexico City, just as his famous uncle had depended upon laws passed in Madrid for the closing down of the ancient capital across the Sabine. This is not my action, the Baron had protested in 1773. It's the king in Madrid who views your town as useless. It's the king who has proclaimed, close down that wasteful place. Victor Ripardá had no baronial title to protect him, and no king in Madrid to offer him a job when his tour on the Mexican frontier ended. He had to rely upon the goodwill of the administrators in Mexico City, whose whims were many. He had learned that if in a post like Nacogdoches he did nothing, made no specific decisions, he could not find himself in trouble. So, prudently, he refused to issue land titles, build a church for the new priest, or authorize the settlement of any of the Americans who were beginning to stream across the Sabine. Mexico's frontier policy, as Americans in Tejas saw it, was, do nothing, and nothing bad can happen to you. Make one mistake, and you may be shot. This was not a fair assessment. When American settlers probed west, they were supported by stable government in Washington and the state capitals. They were backed by a growing economy. They faced Indians, who more often than not could be reasoned with. They were pushed along by a constantly growing population of Englishmen, Scots, and Germans eager to test themselves against the wilderness. And most important, they carried with them ideas of education, freedom, and self-government, ideally suited to the establishment of new governments in new areas. Mexico had an opposite experience, especially in Tejas, where it faced the most intractable Indians in the Americas. It had to rely upon an inadequate number of Hispanic settlers, with no fresh replacements streaming in. Its productive base was limited, and its military disorganized by constant rebellion. The preoccupation of Mexicans was, properly, the founding of a stable government, and in their search they experimented repeatedly with imperialism, republicanism, and liberal democracy,
leaving them little energy for the development of distant territories. Most important of all, whereas Spanish culture had proved itself capable, in both Aztec Mexico and Inca Peru, of overthrowing established civilizations centered upon cities, it was not well adapted to the settling of vast open spaces. Its religion was communal rather than individual. Its educational theories did not apply to the frontier, and the preference of its people for the small, clustered settlement rather than the remote farm proved ill-suited to Tejas. Individual Mexicans like Victor Ripoda were as capable as any Americans, and if their Tejas had consisted of well-defined settlements waiting to be taken over, they would have succeeded, as they did at Santa Fe. But to throw such men into an empty wilderness without adequate support was imprudent, as the Quimper family was discovering. Despite the fact that their papers were in order, they were forced to remain in Nacogdoches for tedious weeks, pestering Ripoda to make up his mind about their land. But he found it expedient to ignore them, to delay making any decision regarding their immigration. And when in desperation they begged him at least to tell them what their prospects were, he laughed. "Me? I have no control over immigration policy. The law says one thing, my superiors say another. Who am I to cut that Gordian knot?" No appeal, no steady decline in the family's funds could move this slim, dapper official. And it became apparent to the Quimpers, especially Matty, who despised the man, that he was capable of keeping them in suspension not just for weeks, but for months or years. Getting a decision out of him? Impossible. And she began agitating for the family to move south toward San Antonio, where some official might be met who would make decisions. Her husband warned that if they left Nacogdoches without permission, Ripoda might dispatch his militia to overtake them, and then they would languish in jail, as many American trespassers did. Matty was all for taking the risk. She yearned to get her seeds planted in land which she could call her own, and she pestered her husband to make the move. But he was afraid. The situation became more complicated one morning when young Yancey came running with exciting news. Many Americans coming from the bayou. And when his parents ran out, they saw that a substantial contingent of immigrants had arrived from the neutral ground, quite different from the customary stragglers who kept drifting in to Ripoda's disgust. These men and women had legal documents attaching them to the settlement plans of a man from Missouri, whose name the Quimpers already knew, but whose reputation for honest dealing they could not yet assess. "The impresario Stephen F. Austin has called for us," the spokesman of the group said. "He has title to vast lands along the Brazos River, and he offers a league and a labor to every family of good reputation." "Do you buy the land?" Quimper asked. And the man said, "No, surveyor's fee only, if I understand correctly." Jubal showed the man his own papers, especially the form signed by Father Clooney, proving that the Quimpers were good Catholics and as such were entitled to their land. The newcomer said, "It's not like the papers we have, an authorization from Austin, but I'm sure it would be acknowledged if you wanted to come along with us." As soon as this suggestion, it was not a promise, was made, the Quimpers unanimously sought to join the Austin group. But when they applied to Ripoda for permission to leave Nacogdoches, he balked. "Stephen F. Austin, I'm aware of. He has empresario rights. His people are free to move south. But you have no rights." And he was adamant. The Quimpers could not leave the north to acquire land, nor could they obtain other land in the north. It was infuriating, but it was standard Mexican procedure. When the new contingent of settlers started south, the Quimpers grew desperate, and Matty wanted to join the procession, whether she was entitled to do so or not. But her husband was afraid to take the risk.
and the three immigrants watched with longing as the caravan moved on. The next days were painful, with Matty even suggesting that they shoot Ripper Da and get going. Her husband hid the three guns and went for the last time to see the administrator. For years, he would remember that meeting. Ripper Da wore a new outfit imported from New Orleans, fawn gray in color, neatly stitched, with new boots to match. He wore one small medal bestowed by a previous administration and an ingratiating smile. "My dear friend Quimper, I would gladly help you if it lay in my power to do so." Whenever he said something like this, he twisted the left side of his mustache, then raised his hands in a gesture of helplessness. "But I am powerless, as you know." He would issue no permissions, make no promises. In fact, he would do nothing at all. And as Jubal's fury rose, Ripper Da's benign calm increased. But as the two men faced each other, Quimper suddenly realized, "If we leave for the South, he won't do anything either. He will never do anything about anything." That night he told his wife and son, "Gather what things we have. At dawn we head south." Before the sun was risen, the three Quimpers were once again laden like oxen, with additional acquisitions from Nacogdoches, among them a stout hoe jutting out from Matty's back. And they were about to sneak away when Father Clooney, awake for his prayers, heard their commotion and ran to intercept them. "Dear children, you must not attempt this. Ripper Da won't have the courage to stop us, you know that." "But I was thinking of the long trail ahead. You cannot travel it bearing such heavy burdens." And while they protested in whispers that they must reach their destination in time to plant their corn, he left abruptly, but soon came back with a gift he had purchased to help these good people on their way, if they ever gained permission to go. It was a handcart, such as peasants throughout the world used for pilgrimages. Two tall wheels shod in iron, a large bed with sides, a canvas cover to guard against rain, two stubby handles with which to guide it. As the priest pushed it forward, he praised the wheels. "Big ones pass easily over bumps. The little ones move faster, but they do catch." Matty, who carried most of the family gear, appreciated what such a cart would mean, and with a glance of thanks went to it ceremoniously, depositing on its oaken bed her new hoe, her cache of food, her sewing kit, her hand shovel, and a dozen other items, some surprisingly heavy. But her sack of corn seed she kept tied to her waist. When the cart had accepted comfortably the family gear, Father Clooney said, "Now we must add the things that will make life more bearable." And he left them again, returning with more gifts, items he knew they would need: another axe, a strong hammer, a hatchet, another spade, a big cross-cut saw, more salt. "And you'd better take this auger to bore holes for the legs of your stools." But by the time all these things were stowed, the sun was well up, and Father Clooney warned his new Catholics, "If you start now, Ripper Da will surely know, and he'll have to arrest you." "But we must go," Matty cried. And he said, "So you shall, for I must move along the rivers to perform marriages and baptisms, and I'm asking for you as my guide and hunter, to provide me with food and protection. I have reason to think that Ripper Da will approve, because otherwise he'll have to send soldiers, and he wouldn't like to do that." So the morning escape was delayed. But by noon, after Father Clooney had met with Commandant Ripper Da, and it was agreed that the Quimpers would accompany him on his journey, they started off. As they left Nacogdoches, Victor Ripper Da bade them goodbye with such warm smiles that one might have thought he had arranged the expedition. "Go, and may God speed you in your great work.
to which Matty Quimper retorted under her breath, "Stay, and may the devil take you on his next visit." The excursion was a joyful experience, for it was March, and the air was warming, and the forests of Texas were threatening to break into leaf. The rivers ran with new vigor, and birds and flowers returned in abundance. To Father Clooney, who recognized this as his last abode on earth, each day was a new delight, and constantly he said to the others, "Imagine having a parish like this, 40 miles to the next cottage, with warmth and love awaiting you when you arrive." He never doubted, not even when he found himself surrounded by Methodists, that when he sat down at dusk, he would be greeted with respect and, in time, with affection. At lonely cabins, he performed weddings and baptisms, usually on the same day. He went to the most forsaken graves, a pile of stone, no more, and said prayers with those who had lost babies and grandfathers. He blessed people. He converted those whose claim to land would otherwise be denied, and he ate voraciously of whatever food the people offered. My father always told me, "Eat beef while you still have teeth. For a long time you'll drink nothing but broth." Few clergymen have ever reported to a new assignment with more abounding love and gratitude than Francis X. Clooney, this exile from Ballycloney. "God has given me a second chance, and I will show my thanks." To Matty, the trip was equally exciting. Landless in Tennessee, the daughter of a wretched man who had to crop on shares without ever receiving his legal allowance, she had married Jubal Quimper because he did have land, and she had watched helplessly as men more clever than he stole that land with spurious documentation and protracted lawsuits. Landless once more, she had traveled across Tennessee and through Arkansas, seeing people far less able than she, enjoying fields and farms and stretches of their own forest. And always before her, as she trudged along, glowed a vision of land which she and her family would one day own. "Every damn thing we do on it will make it better, and our children will make it better still." Land hunger, it would be called in later years, when scholars tried to explain why so many people like Matty poured into Texas, and no better description could be fashioned. She was tired, dead tired of being pushed around, and when she picked up that rifle in the neutral ground and killed the renegade, she felt that she was protecting her right to acquire land when she crossed over into Texas. The vacillations in Nacogdoches had driven her to such desperation that she might indeed have slain Ripper Da had not her husband restrained her. And now, to be freed of those restraints, to be on the way to great expanses of empty land, this was an exploration toward paradise, and she knew it. Despite the relief the handcart provided from beast-like burdens, Matty still did most of the work about the nightly camps. She cooked, she laundered in the rivers, she looked after the priest when rain soaked him and he ran the risk of a cold. She molded the bullets and saved the deerskins for later tanning. She hoarded her supply of salt, dispensing it in niggardly fashion when her husband brought in a portion of some bear he had slain, for then she knew that her crew would eat well. But most important of all, she kept the fires burning when they sputtered, hauling in the fallen timbers herself. For Jubal, the long trip was merely an extended hunting party. Deer, an occasional turkey, pigeon, wild pig, or bear. One day he came rushing back to the camp, shouting like an excited boy, "Matty, Matty, what I seen off to the west!" And at her feet he threw a huge chunk of meat and an animal's tongue 5 times larger than a deer's. "What is it?" she asked. And he said, "I went further than ordinary, that's why I didn't get back last night. Far to the west I saw this movement, huge, like a moving carpet. Know what it was? Buffalo!"
Yep, out there we got buffalo.
What are they like? She asked. And he said simply, Matty, they're so big, so much hair, and they come in such endless numbers.
On some days, when he was certain where Father Clooney and the others were headed so that they could be easily overtaken, he would trek to the west, sit on some mound, and watch the herds moving slowly across an open space where the forest ended and the plains began. And he would wonder if the great beasts could be domesticated. They'd make wonderful cows. They must give milk, else how could they feed their young? But I wouldn't want that bull over there to come charging at me. When he killed one and cut off only the most succulent parts, leaving the rest to rot, he often mused, We never ate so well. No potatoes or flour, but meat like no man ever saw before. He would have been content for the trip to continue endlessly, for he had never before enjoyed such hunting. But when Matty warned him that their supplies of powder and lead were perilously low, he realized that they must soon strike civilization or find themselves in trouble. And he began to ask at lonely cabins along the ancient forest trail, How far to Austin's colony? And invariably the settlers spoke well of the impresario. You can trust that one. He charges for his land, but it's worth it. May move down myself one of these days. He charges? I thought all you paid was the surveyor. Yes, you pay him, but it ain't much. Then you also pay Austin, maybe 12.5 cents an acre, maybe 25. I've heard both.
Quimper stopped, calculating in his head. How much was a league and a labor? Nearly 5,000 acres. Even at 12.5 cents, that would be... Jesus Christ!
It was then that he developed his suspicions about Stephen F. Austin. He's nothing but a Tennessee banker moved south. He asked Father Clooney about this startling development, and the priest said, As I understand it, the way they told me in New Orleans when they gave me the parish, Austin's the only man the Mexican government trusts. He's the only one the American settlers trust. When you get your land from him, you get a clear, sound title. Otherwise, real trouble. Quimper would confide in no one, not even his wife, how much money he was bringing. But Father Clooney gained the impression that he had enough to pay for his acreage if he so desired, but that it galled him to think that he must do so.
Jubal, if paying out a little money ensures a proper beginning, pay it. You'll be happier, and so will your woman.
It don't matter about Matty. She'll do what I tell her.
Jubal, that woman dreams of having her own land. Why else would she work so hard? Get it for her in the right way.
For Yancey Quimper, 11 years old, growing shrewder each day, the trip was a kind of grand awakening.
You told me we would be traveling the Camino Real. Don't look very royal to me.
He was a whining kind of boy, noticing everything and complaining about it.
They ought to build some bridges like we saw in Arkansas.
He also thought the scattered settlers should build better cabins. If they fitted the logs closer, the wind wouldn't blow through. Astutely, he analyzed the elders he was traveling with. Pop don't like work, but everybody seems to like him. When the men play cards at night, they all like Pop. Father Clooney likes whiskey too much, and Mom bites her lip to keep from giving them both hell.
He grew to think of his mother as a workhorse, not masculine like the two men, but not feminine either.
And then, one day, as they approached a well-built cabin by a stream, and Matty saw from a distance a woman in a neat dress, Yancey watched as his mother withdrew from the convoy and stepped behind some bushes, where she slipped out of her dirty buckskins, washed herself in the stream, and then unpacked the gray-blue woolen dress she had brought from Tennessee. When she rejoined the men,
her hair drawn neatly behind her ears and fastened with a cord, she appeared as a tall, handsome woman in her early 30s. And for the first time, her son realized that under different circumstances, she could have been beautiful. When they reached the cabin, she assumed command of the travelers, introducing her husband and the priest, and when the settlers, a family named Seaver, wanted their two children baptized in order to protect their inheritance, she arranged the informal ceremony, even though it had to be Catholic. Father Clooney performed graciously, assuring the Seavers that they were bringing their children into the family of God, and praising them for the loving care they had obviously bestowed upon their offspring. Yancey noticed, during the prayer, that upon any likely occasion Father Clooney spoke of love, and one morning he asked about this, and was told gently, "Son, we're forced by circumstance to lead harsh and sometimes cruel lives. We're driven from our villages. We live in exile along El Camino Real. We lose our health, and sanity seems not to abide with us. What really is left?" At this point, Yancey realized the old fellow was describing his own condition. "The love that God bestows upon us," Clooney said, "and the love that we share with one another, that's all we have." "Who do you love?" Yancey asked, and the priest replied in dreamlike sentences. "I love the bishop who sent me into this exile because it was his duty to do so. I love Victor Ripperda, who treated us so poorly because he bears great burdens. I love the Seavers, who watch over their children in this wilderness. And I love you, Quimpers, for the bold way in which you face life."